Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy for September 14 of 2012. Nolak at Cadillac. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Renzo.
Johnny.
How you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing really good, actually.
Great.
I've been running all over the place, half ragged, but it's great to just sit down here and talk shop.
Yeah. Gary's joining us.
And we got Gary Vasilash back with us.
John.
From Automotive here. Design and Production Magazine.
How you guys doing?
Auto Field Guide.
Yeah.
There seems to be a big shiny black thing in the studio.
We have a Cadillac ATS in the studio because we've got David Leone, the chief engineer of Cadillac, joining us later in the show. And as you know, we love having cars in the studio. It's the way it should be done.
And engineers and designers and the people who are in
the true believers, as you call them. Mm-hmm.
As I call them, and the people in the trenches that make it happen.
What's what the business is all about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everybody gets all hung up on all these other issues. It's about making cars that people want to buy. It's that easy.
Yeah, it's real simple.
Right. And Peter, you got to explain, why do I have this Triumph baseball hat in
That's
my hands?
That's a brand new, unworn Triumph motorcycle baseball hat that I ordered and does not really fit me. It's a one-size-fits-all. It's an elastic.
Oh, yeah. It's a stretcho.
And if I wore it, I mean, I guess if I wore it a lot, it would fit, but in the interim, it would probably cut my circulation off.
So what little blood gets to your brain right now
brain
would be cut
shrivel.
Off completely.
So we're going to have a little trivia question later.
No, let's do it now, okay. And then we'll pick a winner at the end of the show.
Okay.
So you know the question?
I sent it to you, but
yeah,
we can. I think I can recreate it.
Hey.
A Cadillac powered or Cadillac was entered at the 24-hour Le Mans for the very first time. What year was it? And who entered the car?
But it was not a Cadillac. It was a Cadillac-powered car.
Well, no, there were two.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had it wrong. There were two. There was a production Cadillac and a Cadillac custom car.
So you're looking for the Cadillac, not the car powered by a Cadillac.
Yeah, well, it doesn't, you know, who entered the car, what year was it?
Yeah, gotcha.
Did Dave win?
No, Dave Leone does not count. But so if you think you know the answer, get on the internet right now. By the end of the show, we're going to pick a winner. Shoot us an email. Send it to viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv. Put something like Cadillac race car or something like that in the subject line. And tell us where you're from, too, because we like to give out not just people's names, but where they're from. And we'll pick a winner by the end of the show.
Cool.
So Peter, I got to say that your column yesterday with the glossary to
of terms,
the automotive terms, and it was just brilliant. And your Abercrombies,
yeah.
That it. So I Business Week just ran a story about Abercrombie and Fitch, and I thought it was very interesting. It says, and I quote: "The once edgy retailer has lost a third of its market value in the past year as it grapples with falling sales in Europe and the U.S." While Abercrombie blames the economy for its woes, brand consultants say it has also failed to change with the times. And it just sort of struck me that basically, so here is this really once trendy brand, and that there are people in the auto industry who are trying to emulate that. And here's a case where, you know, you're emulating something that has basically gone off the cliff.
Yeah, I know. Well, we've all seen the photo sets. You know, they show them sometimes at media previews. This is what our designer started with. This is what our marketing team is. This is a photo set of the people and the lifestyles of things they do. Well, you know, even though, especially for small cars, the Abercrombie models were high on the list. I mean, I remember seeing all of them, even though none of them can afford even, you know, any kind of a new car. So I just dubbed them the Abercrombies. But yeah, as you point out, they're nowhere. Mm-hmm. They're done. It's over.
Yeah. So what a thing to follow, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just like, yeah, we'll go down in that direction. And so even, you know, even the originator now is at it.
Originator is toast.
But that's a great list. I think that was just
thanks.
Very well done.
Yeah, I enjoyed reading that too. All the different terminology. Wow, the terms are one thing. It's the definitions that made the column.
There is some inside baseball in there, as what people expect, and a few, you know, the kind that yell about each other. I know who he's talking about. I work with one of those guys.
Speaking of working with one of those guys, looks like Mark Fields is going to be raised to be the official successor to the throne at Ford.
Yeah, named COO probably before the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Although they met about it today, but they're not going to announce it.
Right. The board met today to consider what they're going to do. And
I mean, it's no big surprise.
No, not at all.
I think Mark has been groomed for that for a while, and I think it's... He, whenever he was asked, he'd say,
Well, all of them say that. You ask any executive, you want to be CEO, and they dance all around the question.
No, because if you say you do and you don't get the job, I mean, how do you end up looking, right? I mean,
well, it's not only that. You know, you got to be politically correct, and it's like, you know, I just work very hard, and if, you know, it gets to be that, so be it. But no one's ever said, yeah, I want to be CEO, and I'll do whatever it takes to be it.
And then, you know, Alan will stand for another year. Maybe to the end of next year, but now there's rumors that they might ask him to be non-executive chairman, just to still be involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I don't know what that means. He'd come into Dearborn once a month from Washington, or
well, make the board meetings. You know, at least do that. Yeah. I think they want to make sure that his process stays in place. And
I think Mark Fields will keep his process straight. Straight up, right?
I agree.
You know, Mark's big thing is he's got some huge challenges. You know, when he assumes that ultimate job, I mean, no one executive can fix the European thing.
Right.
They can sort of react. And
Europe can't even fix the European thing.
Yeah, they can't even fix it. So these automakers, their leaders are forced to just react and try to minimize the damage and the losses. But when you have, you know, these ironclad union arrangements in these European plants, they can't close plant. I don't know what's going to happen there.
It's going to be a bloodbath. I mean, I think it's going to be bad for a number of years.
Yeah. And now they're talking about some sort of a stimulus, you know, bailout even, but...
But, you know,
doesn't solve the problem.
You know, and, you know, the last thing Europe needs is Americans telling them what to do, but they should learn from the experience here. Bite the bullet, take the bitter medicine, whatever cliche you want to use, but solve the root cause of the problem. And the root cause right now is there's way too much capacity. So on average, none of them nor their suppliers can make decent profits. The Germans are a different thing, but that's because they export so much. And, you know, to build your brand, if you're a Peugeot or a Citroën or a Fiat, up to where the Germans are, that's a multi-decade process. And so you've got to fix the root cause of the problem right now.
Well, but the problem is an economic problem. It's not a car maker problem. And I think that the real issue is...
No, it's a car maker problem, well, Gary, because look at what happened in the U.S. where... You know, we're doing handsprings this year. We're going, woohoo, the American market's going to hit 14.4 million units. Go back 5 years ago, that would have been a disaster. Absolute unmitigated disaster.
Right.
They're all solidly profitable. So are all their dealers. So are all their suppliers. Everybody's making money on the car business right now. So even if you get the European economy back on track, and who knows how many years that's going to take, the industry would still be saddled with way too much capacity. And still... with the exception of the Germans, not be able to make any money.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking from the point of view of you look at you know, Greece, you look at Italy, you look at Spain, Ireland. I mean, you have this situation where these economies are just teetering. You gonna go buy a car? I don't think so, right? Because you don't know, you know what's going to happen. And, you know, at the same time, you've got that, so you've got the problem with the euro, that you have this, you know, as you were saying, they have these ironclad agreements. I mean, so you have this whole history of this socio-political labor situation, which they have in Germany and seem to be handling all right. But, you know, so you've got to, you know, it's got to be root cause that they've got to take care of. And, you know, and that comes down to the entire European Union rather than just to say, okay, the auto industry is going to take care of this mess, because right. It just isn't.
But the auto industry can't take care of the European Union, but it can take care of itself. And if they were to get to where probably the American industry is today, that's roughly a break-even point of about 10.5 million, but they're selling 14.5 million. That's why they're so solidly profitable. That's what the European Union or the European auto industry needs to do, is get itself down to a break-even of 10.5 million units. And even right now today, they'd all be solidly profitable. So you got to take care of what you can control. And they can control their own, well, they should be able to control their overcapacity.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a, boy, I hope they get that straightened out, because I hate seeing them in the where they are right now. I mean, they've already fallen off the edge of the cliff, and they can't see how far they're going to fall.
Getting back to Mark Fields, I mean, he's going to stay the course. The processes that Alan Mulally put in place, the Thursday meetings and everything like that, that is not going to change.
I agree with you. Mark believes in that.
Yeah, Mark has said.
I think it's changed Mark, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
I think he's a better executive now because of, well, you know, everybody learns by doing, but I think that process is really
Well, he's
him.
Sat at Alan's right hand, and so he, you know, he knows it inside and out, and he's not going to do anything that.
So then the question who's going to get Fields?
You know, I'm not so sure it'll just be same as it ever was, because, you know, you go back, and the analogy that I'm thinking about is Jack Welch changing General Electric. Okay, they had a series of CEOs before Welch that were, you know, not doing great things for that company by any stretch of the imagination, and they were falling into successes where they had them, and they were tripping over themselves. You know, Welch came in, had a methodology, had a vision, had an approach, and just took that company to the top. So then he's going to retire, right? So what do you do? I mean, I don't recall them having a discussion of saying, well, he'll be this, you know, this ghostly chairman that'll come back in and check things out. But he makes a decision who he's going to pick, and as we all remember, one of the guys who didn't make it was our
Bob Nardelli.
Bob Nardelli, yeah. So
who went to Chrysler ultimately,
right?
And then left.
so Jeff Immelt got it, right? And he's kept the company very successful, but he's doing it Jack's way, but he's doing it his way.
Oh, I think
so. You have that growth.
There's no question Mark is going to bring his perspective to the job, but he's not going to go in and upset the apple cart right out of the gate.
Over.
No, I mean, Mark is going to, you know, grow the Mulally way.
Yeah, what Mulally's brought to that company is this Thursday morning meeting where the top 14 officers of the company review every aspect of the business every single week. So all the top officers in the company are fully aware of everything that's going on elsewhere in the company. And this concept of each one of them has to bring an invitee to the meeting from anywhere in the company, not just necessarily other higher management, not even middle management. It could be a secretary. It could be a guy, a mechanic in the garage. And so he's diffusing or driving information throughout the organization that way. And think what people that work at the company believe when they've been invited into the inner sanctum to see what the top officer is. I mean, what a way to tell your people you trust them completely. And then, as Mulally told me, is not only do they go back to their own work areas and talk about what they saw and experienced, they start doing the same thing. They start Thursday morning meetings where everybody gets together and starts reviewing the business. And that's what I believe is changing the culture. So even though undoubtedly Mark Fields will take the Ford Motor Company in different areas, because the world changes and you've got to react to those changes, I think this core way of driving information throughout the business and making everybody participate in the business, which I think has driven morale there to levels I've never seen at Ford, I don't think that's going to change.
Yeah. You know, contrasting Alan's style, I mean, Sergio goes about it in his own way. You know, I mean, that's just the way he, what's he have, 32 plus direct reports.
I know, it's crazy.
You know, the problem is, you know, if Alan wants to step away, those processes are in place.
Ford's got a deep bench.
Yeah. When Sergio,
Chrysler does too, but we don't know who's going.
Well, when Sergio steps away, there's going to be an issue because that company is set up at upper management. The superstructure is set up for Sergio. There is not anyone in, even on their bench, that who is going to want to do that, and they're going to have to change. There's going to be some issues there.
There'll be big management structural change when he decides to retire.
Because he does it one way.
Right.
And, you know, that's a way that's really not conducive to, like, a logical successor. Who's a logical successor? Who wants 32 direct reports or plus direct reports?
A lot of levers to pull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he likes doing that, but I mean,
yeah, no, he thrives on it.
But he's setting up a company that will have to have a really excruciating transition.
That's right. That's right.
So that's kind of the difference here.
So before we leave Ford, I got to say, did you see the announcement today about their battery technology?
No.
I mean, they made this big deal out of the fact that for the Fusion and the C-Max hybrid about their batteries, that their Ford's third generation hybrid system, which replaces nickel metal hydride batteries with newer, lighter lithium ion batteries, blah, blah, blah. And they're talking about how they're much lighter and they use far less rare earth, on and on and on. And I started thinking about that for a minute. Let's see. Nickel metal hydride batteries, lithium ion technology, entirely different chemistries. And so, you know, this thing goes on for three pages about how they've done these wonderful things. So I contacted a friend of mine at General Motors who is in batteries and said, gee, isn't this just because they switched from nickel metal hydride to lithium ion that this is being achieved? I mean, and he's like, yeah. And this is like every single one of our cars that uses lithium ion batteries. You know, we didn't know that was a big deal. You know, it's just, and it just struck me as being so bizarre, and that to try to get run off of something like, do you guys know there's air in this room right now? Lots of air. This is so bizarre.
To quote a guy I heard on the BBC years ago, he said, heavens, next they're going to tell us the Thames is full of water.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
But leave it to Ford. I mean, they know how to market stuff. It's, remember how we all laughed at EcoBoost? Oh, how can they brand an engine that happens to have a turbo on
right. It?
It's worked.
And it's worked
consumers.
Brilliantly.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll probably get people writing about
this. Oh,
they
did. I mean, I've seen it show up all over the place. And it's like they invented it. And I'm thinking, wait a minute.
Sometimes you just got to go out and invent it yourself. Right. Tell people, and pretty soon they said, I guess they did it.
Hey, I got to ask you, Peter, about 911s, because I've just been driving a 911S turbo cabrio this week.
So that's the last of the previous generation 911.
Yeah. It's an awesome car.
It's a hot car.
Oh, my God. I don't know how to describe the acceleration, except that you hit the gas, and it makes this kind of whooshing noise, and where you were looking way down the road, now you're there.
Yeah.
It should have a warp speed indicator, yeah. Not an, you know.
What color was it?
Silver. So,
nice.
And a $3,100 optional paint job on it. I got to tell you, my jaw dropped. It was $189,000 MSRP on the thing. I had no clue they went that high.
It had the Carrera GT Silver, I'm
yes.
sure.
Yes, yeah. It did.
That's
yes,
beautiful,
it did.
Beautiful class, but, German silver. And you know, that's the end of that car, and then the new car is the 991, which
mm-hmm.
I'm driving.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went to the Long Lead in Santa Barbara in November, and, you know, I've had a lot of 911s and a Boxster and a Cayman. And, you know, what was impressive about the new car is it's different. It's slightly bigger, but it's lighter. And it's quicker, and you know they've done away with the traditional 911 steering, and all the purists are going, oh, it's the end of the world. You know, I got to tell you, I've driven the new car, and it feels great. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, wow, I just need to go back because the other one was better. I think it's fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was talking to the chief engineer back then, and another huge difference is the wider track in front. It makes a huge difference in the handling of the car, the feel of the car. So you drove the last of the previous generation in its most extreme form. Mm-hmm. I'm driving the new 911 in the standard form. Both great cars.
Yeah.
Really great cars. I mean, Porsche, I don't know. What can you say? Everything they seem to jump on, they seem to get right.
Well, you know, like Carl Ludvigsen told us, excellence was expected. Yeah.
And I'm hearing from inside that the new Macan, which is based on the Q5, is stunning in its performance potential in the turbo form.
What I just read today, they've doubled their sales target from 35,000 a year to 70,000 a year.
Well, I thought that's an internal target, right?
Well, whatever it is, that's
a target, right?
Huge number for them. I mean, this is a company that does, what, 180,000 cars mm-hmm. globally, 190,000? They don't even do 200,000 cars a year globally. So to add one model that might bump it up another 70,000 units, that's huge.
Well, they've got a whole bunch of models coming, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why when, you know, we had Walter De Silva here last year, he was talking about they think they can double Porsche sales globally. And I'd agree with them.
Well, I guess globally, as long as they don't lose their mojo.
As long as they don't do that, that's the key.
That's the key.
Hey, why don't we take our first break here? Because I'm dying to get David Leone on the show here. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. So, David Leone, great having you here with us.
Good to be here. Thanks, John.
And I've been saying that right. Chief engineer for Cadillac?
Yeah, we changed recently executive chief engineer for our rear-wheel drive and luxury cars. So it includes the all-new ATS, CTS, Camaro, our Holden products out of Australia, and some other things we can't talk about.
Oh, my gosh. So.
Like the CL. So, wow, that's a cool job. I
mean, it is. I'm very fortunate.
That's a great job.
Very fortunate.
And we've got our ATS here in the studio with us, and this is a completely new platform?
It's all new architecture, okay? This is the first entry off of this architecture. It is scalable, okay?
Meaning you can make it bigger or smaller?
Go bigger or smaller based on what the needs are. It is very efficient, okay? We came in, we set an objective up front to be the lightest vehicle in its segment and class, and we're very proud to say that we believe we've accomplished that.
That's an impressive feat unto itself. I mean, looking at the big picture of General Motors, Detroit, you know, that's a real achievement.
Well, it must have been a real target within GM, because GM's built good cars, but man, they're all heavy. They're all heavier than the competition.
Right.
Until this one.
From the onset, that was one of our objectives, okay? And we got the support all the way up through our leadership to show the world what General Motors can do, and we can be efficient. And this is proof of that. At 3,315 pounds, it's nimble, quick, and fun, which is what we've set out to be. And I think for a few of you that had a chance to drive it, you can verify that.
And so what was the biggest contributing factor to your being able to reduce the weight of that vehicle?
Well, to get the weight right, you start out with making sure the vehicle is sized appropriately, okay? It's not wider or longer or taller than it needs to be. The tire size is a driver of how heavy a car is. You can take a few parameters, tire size, powertrain mass, and then the plan view area, and typically we can get within probably 50 pounds of what that car is going to weigh.
Really?
Well, we worked, yes.
So you want small tires? But the customer doesn't.
Yeah, well, we don't have small wheels, okay? These are very low-profile tires, and those are actually the tallest tires that we have in this vehicle, or 45 series. We have both 40 and 35 series tires that are also available. These are the 17s on this model. And then as you go ahead and you size this, we make sure that we have the right topology. Now, topology is basically designing the body and chassis together. So that, you know, typically you have the body group that's coming up with what is the best body design, and the chassis group has got the greatest kinematics and chassis design to get the right handling and ride, and then you merge them together, and then you find out, well, the body wants an attachment here and the chassis wants an attachment here, and they're not in the exact same spot. Differently on this one, we said from day one to go ahead and get this lightest approach and lightest execution, do them together so that if the chassis wants attachments here, well, let's put the body stiffest point right at where that chassis attachment is and put it directly in line. You know, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. The most efficient design is a straight element. So anytime you have to put a bend or a kink in something to go ahead and get around another component, you decrease its efficiency. And so straight elements are the most mass efficient design. And you don't have to add material height or flanges or up gauge to go ahead and compensate for it. So if you get straight elements and you get them attached in the most efficient area so you don't have these offsets, you can go ahead and create the right design and the lightweight design.
So is that just making the chassis and body guys work together?
Work together, okay. And what we said was is that from day one, we were going to count every gram every day with every engineer, okay? And so typically we dealt in kilograms and pounds. We had to convert the mindset, no, we're going to deal in grams, okay? So, for example, on this car here, we have in the body alone, we got about 3 kilograms of lightning holes and scalloped flanges. And these are low-stressed areas where you could just remove material through putting holes in it. And that's on the body side. You got similar reductions in the chassis. We also use a lot of advanced materials. That was another enabler. When you typically go with mild steel, which is what doors and hoods and fenders are made out of.
Historically made out of.
You know, the previous generation here with our current CTS that's out there, we've got a lot of high-strength steel, okay? In this vehicle, we have some high-strength steel, but we've got advanced high-strength steel, and we've got ultra-high-strength steel. And it's up to another 3 times in yield strength what high-strength steel is. And so that's an enabler for getting the same part to perform better with smaller section and lighter mass.
So it's thinner, but it isn't any less capable.
Absolutely. So you solve it. You solve it with some dollars as opposed to more mass and bigger components.
And you have an aluminum hood on that car.
We have an aluminum hood on that car. We have magnesium engine mount brackets. We've got magnesium steering wheel paddle shifters that are real that you touch. You can feel that cold metal when you're driving. We have aluminum shock towers. We have aluminum front cradle. We have all aluminum suspension components up front.
And let's go back to those shock towers a minute, because I've never seen anything like it. Maybe others have done it, but I've never seen it because they're cast.
They're cast. They're single cavity cast shock towers.
And they're pretty good size.
They are, and they're about 40% lighter and 14 fewer parts than if we would have made them out of steel.
So even though you're spending more on material, you're spending less on tooling and assembly?
You are. And we are up front established a dollars per kilogram target that we were willing to spend. And we said for the team, and so we don't give away the secret sauce, okay, we established a value. And we said, if it's below this value, I want you to just go do it. You don't need to even come talk to me about what the mass reduction or what it's going to cost. If it's below this dollar value, I want you to go do it. If it's in this range, let's talk about it. And if it's above this level, it's probably not right for this entry in the segment.
So you're making a car with advanced materials that are more expensive than mild steel. I mean, mild steel,
correct.
You know, what we
right.
have in our wallets, we could probably buy enough to mm-hmm. build a car with. But presumably you had a price target, because, I mean, this is not a, you know, a wildly expensive car.
It's not.
Despite the fact that, you know, you're using aluminum and magnesium.
No.
And,
no,
ultra high strength steels and so on.
And then as I started to go, you start with the right size, make sure the vehicle size is right. You get with the right topology, which means efficient body and chassis design together. Then you select the right materials, okay? And then you optimize it to all get out, okay? Making sure that it's not any bigger, any stronger than it has to be. You know, our previous approach would have been to take the largest tire and wheel, the heaviest powertrain, all-wheel drive configuration, and then we would design it to, you know, be able to withstand nuclear attack, all right? And, you know, that we could handle any kind of police guard duty. That's not what we did here. We took intelligent risk. We took the, if you will, the tire size that is the highest penetrating, and we went ahead and we designed around that, fully optimized around that, and then we take intelligent risk elsewhere. And that's what enables it to be just as it is.
Which model is that? I mean, which engine is
it? Actually, it is the 2-liter turbo, which is the engine that's in the middle class. We have three engines. We've got a 2.5 four-cylinder at 202 horsepower. We have a 2-liter turbo at 272 horsepower. And then we have our 3.6-liter naturally aspirated at 321 horsepower. And so we took the middle engine, we took the 17-inch tire and wheel, which is the heaviest penetrating, and we designed and optimized around that. And we, again, worked the secret sauce around it and came up with what you see.
So let's go back to the cost a minute, because as you said, you're doing things that typically add cost to a car, these different materials and the like. And sure, you did a great job of designing it, so everything's straight, you're mm-hmm. not adding brackets mm-hmm. or gussets mm-hmm. or whatnot. How do you keep the price down, the cost down?
Yeah, through efficiency and through scale, okay, because it's scalable. We have intentions of using some of these design solutions elsewhere. When it comes to the electronic side of the business, for example, the Cadillac Q system, it's the same system that's in the XTS, that's in the ATS, that'll be in the SRX, et cetera. So you can use that same solution across multiple models. And through the added volume, you can get scale and you can get price reduction. When the supplier doesn't have to engineer it 2 and 3 and 4 times over, he's willing to share his savings with you as well. And that works throughout the entire vehicle. Same thing with the powertrain configurations. So, through scale.
In the past, anytime a chief engineer wanted to add new technology to a car, you took the full financial hit for it. In fact, a lot of them said, no, thank you. I'm not going to take the full financial hit on my program. Mm-hmm. Has that changed within GM of how you allocate cost when introducing new technology?
We share it, okay? Again, without getting into the formulas, but we do go ahead and spread the burden across the users. And we have an understanding. We have targets that each one of us have to hit for our programs so they don't get approved, because we're in business to make money. That's the while we're all here, okay? We need to hit those targets, but we can share that development cost, and you get a portion of that investment and engineering cost that it takes to execute it. So, yes, it's distributed.
So speaking of sharing, okay, I want you to do a public service for chief engineers everywhere. So all of us always ask you guys about platforms and architectures, and we throw those words around, and I think that we all have in our own minds an idea of what that means. So could you define for us what that means?
Okay, I'll try. And it's similar from car company to car company, but it has to do with the same design solution. It may not be the exact same part, okay, because you can have an architecture between different models, and it would be the same architecture, but have different wheelbase or different height, okay, and so there's certain things that you can change, but you don't change the fundamentals. You don't change the primary suspension geometry. You don't change the cradles. You don't change the powertrain configurations. But you have the same design solutions that are there, and they're scalable based on the size of the vehicle. It's typically a single team that will design and execute that across the bandwidth. We talk about bandwidths, and for example, I know what the minimum bandwidth of this platform is, and I know how big it'll go, and if I go any bigger, then I need to redesign major components. And so we establish that up front, and we say this will go from, you know, the entry lux segment to above prestige, and it's capable of 2-seat roadsters, and it's capable of, you know, 4-door sedans and coupes and wagons. And so that would define an architecture, is the family of vehicles that come off of those same primary components. It's usually the body structure that you can't see. So none of the panels that the customer can see or touch would be the same, but it's the underlying structure that is below it. We used to call it black metal. We don't do that anymore. But it'd be the underlying structure, and then we do what we call like top hat, meaning the fender's hood, roof, greenhouse is all unique. And again, you can play with width, and you can play with wheelbase, and the but the like for example, the front wheel center to driver position is typically the same within that architecture. You don't play with some of those. Those are fundamentals that when you start to move those building blocks around, they get real expensive.
I like the aerodynamic attention to detail that you went on this car. In fact, for what I've seen so far for a volume production car, i.e. don't count Porsches and Ferraris mm-hmm. and the like, mm-hmm. your underbody treatment for aerodynamics is the best I've ever seen.
Yeah, it goes from front to rear, okay, and no surface was ignored. We have full belly pans that basically go from the nose to about where the driver sits. We close out things like control arms on the bottom side because we were getting turbulent air there.
And that I've never seen done before.
Right.
They're like little plastic attachments that
they
go
are.
On the very bottom of the control arms.
They are, and we found that they were worth a few counts. And they were,
which is extraordinary.
Yes.
A few
yes.
pieces of plastic and you pick up some counts.
You got it. Closeouts around the muffler in the rear. Okay. We have little spats that are around the wheels that, again, deflect air away from the tire, keep it nice laminar flow so the air doesn't get separated. Things like the rear stop lamp, the center high-mounted stop lamp, also, you know, contributes to aero and minimizes rear lift, creating some downforce. But we have shutters on the front of this vehicle that you can't see them through the grill, but they're behind the grill. And so that you don't open up, the more airflow you have going through the radiator to cool the vehicle, the more drag that you have. And so we go ahead and we close those off so that when you're running down the road at normal speeds, 70 miles an hour or less, you don't need them. When you get more spirited or you start going to you know, Pikes Peak or Hoover Dam, or you need more cooling, we open them up, and but you don't need those for everyday driving. See, it's there when you need it, but not when you don't want it.
And what this car is a 0.29?
299.
299.
Yeah, we got it just under 0.3, which was our objective we set out early. And
which is harder to do with a smaller car, right?
It
a shorter
is.
Car is harder to get clean through the air.
It absolutely is. So, but, you know, little attention to detail everywhere.
And it's got to make the car less wind noise.
It absolutely does. It's quieter. The less drag, the less turbulence you have, whether around mirrors. We have, you know, aero targets and wind noise targets for a mirror. And so we get down to that level of detail.
Did you do benchmarking of other vehicles when
extensively,
you were...
Extensively.
So what were some of those?
Well,
the regular suspects, right?
Yeah,
3 Series.
Three Series, the Audi A4. I mean, it depends on which systems you're looking at. You know, when it comes to the chassis dynamics, the BMW 3 Series has been the industry leader and recognized. When it comes to interior refinement, the Audi A4 is probably one of the stronger ones in the segment. When it comes to structural integrity, the Mercedes-Benz, the C-Class, is pretty stellar there as well. And so it's very tough competition here, and so we benchmarked them all, and we laid out all their parts and pieces and picked in the areas where we wanted to beat them, where were we willing to come in at the same level, and where did we think that they had some excess that wasn't necessary, the customer didn't really appreciate. And that's all part of the, if you will, developing the right formula.
So to do this, you literally got the cars and you took them completely apart?
We bought two of them. We bought one that we could keep and drive and do all of our dynamic testing and evaluation, and not only initially, but for probably better part of 2 years. And then the other ones, we went ahead and cut apart and took apart, cut apart, did everything we wanted to do with them, measured for stiffnesses, doing body modals on them. But that's not anything that's new. A lot of us do that, and so you can learn, and that's exactly what we did.
Mm-hmm.
So the most extensive benchmarking we've probably ever done. That's the result.
So talk about that base engine. It's an all-new four-cylinder engine.
It is.
And I got to tell you, at full throttle, usually most four cylinders get pretty buzzy. This one sounds really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With the direct mount accessories, with the forged steel cranks, with the aluminum block, it's very quiet. And we work to tune that sound with our powertrain team to make sure that it didn't sound like it was straining. Okay. And again, there's some secrets in there that you don't want to talk about, but
that's okay. In their teardowns,
yeah,
they'll
find them. They've got all those pieces there on the floor right now somewhere. Yeah.
And you have to spend money on some of these things, you know, with balance shafts, with direct injection. Direct injection is, you know, a very high pressure fuel system that's capable of giving you greater power and fuel efficiency. But when you run at 30 times the pressure of a normal injection system, it's noisier.
Right.
And so you've got to do things to isolate and make that quieter. Otherwise, you don't like what it sounds like. And so that's some of the learnings we went through as well.
And the six-cylinder is used in this car as well as in the XTS. Is that right?
It is.
And the
SRX. It is.
And yet they all have different horsepower ratings.
The XTS and the SRX are right around 302 horsepower. In this application, it's 321 horsepower. And we were able to achieve that through a lower intake restriction on the front end and lower exhaust restriction. With that improvement, refinement, we were able to get another 20 horsepower.
So straight pipes out the back.
They are, yeah, just like God intended the engines to be going north-south.
So again, to your point you made earlier about the straight line versus if you had a transverse setup, you'd have a 90-degree angle.
You do, and you have fewer bends, and you get more efficiency in the exhaust system when they can go straight out the back.
If you could change anything on the car for the next go-round, is there anything you guys are thinking of? Or that's too far ahead?
Well, we're just launching this one. We just started shipping it about 10 days ago.
Yeah, I know, but okay. I know how you guys work.
Right. You've built 300 of them, I think.
I mean, we continue to work on additional models and variants and things like
that. But I'm thinking this has got a 6-speed automatic transmission. I got to believe one of the next things that you're looking at is a gearbox with more gears in it.
We are. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
There are other body styles. We already know that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Coupe.
So how long did this program take? When did you start working on it? And
a little over 5 years ago.
5 years?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there was this unpleasantness called the bankruptcy that interrupted the work, too.
We went through a period.
A bad patch.
We went through a rough patch, okay? And in that rough patch, that got delayed a little bit, okay? And there were some speeds that got delayed and things like that, that as a result of the bad patch.
Would you say that cost a year? It's hard to say.
And how are you measuring? I mean, you're not measuring from clay freeze to job one, are you?
Actually, no. I want to say this one was 21 months from styling freeze to start of regular production.
See, that's fast.
That part was fast. It was getting to that point where it was
all the teardowns, all the market studies, all that.
You got it. And you need to do some of that stuff. We've been planning this for a while. This goes well back into the Rick Wagner days, and
you must be happy too, because GM's had a habit of targeting the best car in class, building something that will compete against it. And by the time the car came out, the competition was already a next generation.
How did you deal with that? I mean, because that
stay the course. As we went ahead and benchmarked some of the competition, for example, BMW's had a couple of generations here. And we picked earlier generation as the one that we thought was the best dynamically. And, you know, as the...
Then they went to the new car.
They went to the new car, got bigger, wider, taller. And there were forces inside the company saying, should we go ahead and make this one bigger, wider, taller? No. We want to stay the course. This is about being nimble, quick, and fun. This is going to give you that opportunity where the fuel economy requirements are escalating. Those don't get any easier the bigger, wider, heavier that you get. okay? And we said, no, this is the way to deliver that objective. And we got the right support and continued with it. So stay the course.
And what plans for selling this car outside of the U.S. market?
It'll be the primary markets are the United States, China, and Europe, okay? But it is sold in about 40 countries around the world, like today's CTSs. So it's in the Middle East, and it's in Russia, and, you know, it's quite a few different places.
And so diesels, because if you're not playing with diesels in the European market, especially in the luxury segment, you've essentially taken 70% of your potential sales away.
Right, right. Diesel is the powertrain of choice in Europe. We don't have anything to announce right now, but we continue to work on those
things. We'll focus on the right now part
of that
statement.
That's right.
But presumably you have it designed to be adaptable.
Oh, it's very capable. It's very capable of that. So, yes.
And when you were talking about the benchmark, it was all European, no Asian. Is that the way it was, or were there? Did you look at Infiniti and Lexus?
We did look at Infiniti and Lexus, and you know, from a chassis dynamic standpoint, the Infiniti is actually fairly strong. But it's quirky. And then Lexus is quiet. They're not predominant players. They're not the volume players. It's not where the appeal is. And so when you look at who the big dogs are, those are the ones that we went after.
That's great. Well, we ought to get the audience in with some of their questions on this. Why don't we take a quick commercial break right now and come back and do the rapid-fire part of the show.
Okay.
So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no! That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
How did you like the ad campaign, by the way, for ATS?
You know, I thought it was fantastic. You know, it was, you know, the first all-new approach. We're entering a new segment. We had to establish some credibility. We had to change the mindset. We had to get relevant in the minds of the folks that we were trying to appeal to. And we thought that a new cinematic approach would be the way to do it. And I think they hit the ball out of the park. Molly Peck and her team, the Cadillac marketing team, did a fantastic job with that.
Peter, you're the advertising guy. You agree with that?
I do like the ATS campaign. I'm a little biased, but it really doesn't matter because he's so good. But Jeff Swart was one of the shooters on it. And he's an old friend of mine, but he does such superb work. And I thought, you know, you had to gain a modicum of attention out there. You had to remember when we had Joe on here, he said, we just have to gain some notoriety before you even can get consideration.
Well, what I like what Joel Iwanek said is we just need to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, right.
We don't want somebody pulling up in an ATS and their friends with their 3 Series and C Classes go, why did you buy that? Mm-hmm. He said, if you pull up in an ATS and they go, oh, yeah, I understand why you'd buy a car like that, he said, you know, mission accomplished.
So they have to, speaking of stay the course, they have to stay the course in that campaign. They've got to hammer it.
Yes.
We all remember what BMW did when they were really, really on the upward trajectory. They hammered that same, remember that series of black and white commercials that BMW did for a while? That was, you know, and it worked. Mm-hmm. So, but traditionally, Detroit automakers have a short attention span in marketing. They just said, well, yeah, we did that. Let's do something else. But, you know, if they stay with what they're doing and keep hammering away, they'll be part of the discussion.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then they've delivered the real deal, so it's not one of these situations where
you've got this
wonderful campaign and it's like, that's the car?
Yeah, this has come together nicely because all the reviewers say generally the same thing.
Yes.
That the car is very capable, very competent, and it belongs in the discussion.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So kudos to you and your troops, the true believers over there at GM.
I'll share that with them. We're very proud of how that turned out.
Cool. Well, let's get to rapid fire. Ben, let it rip. Okay, David, first question here is Rum and Coke. He says, have those shutters been tested in severe winter conditions? What about road salt and other corrosion? I'm saying, what about ice?
Yes, they have been. Okay, they have been tested. We test with all four seasons. We test in our Capus casing facility, which is about 500 miles north of Toronto, which is a winter facility where 40 degrees C and 40 degrees F equal the same. Okay,
and you've seen that.
We've seen that. I've been up there. You don't want to visit there too often. But yes, the answer is we've taken through that testing. We've been through salt and corrosion. We run 10 years of corrosion at our Milford Proving Grounds with salt spray baths and corrosion booths, and the answer is yes. And it also needs to be compliant with emissions compliance because it affects fuel economy, and it can have an effect on powertrain performance. They need to be very carefully validated, and we can check that box and say that's done.
But GM is using that, and they're using it in the cruise.
We are. Yeah. First, the rolled out on the cruise here, and you will see it elsewhere. It's fundamentally, it's the right thing to do.
Everyone's going to use it.
I mean, no more airflow than you need. They're not inexpensive. I mean, they are quite expensive, but they have benefit. They have both benefit on schedule and real-world benefit in fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. So they're little motors that make them work?
Yeah, consider it like a Venetian blind, okay, with a linkage. And they're louvers, and basically you open them up with a small little motor and a linkage, and that's what they look like.
So the engine control module sends them a signal and says close now or open now or go halfway down? Or
You got it, yes, in terms of we tell it how much air we need. And so, yes, we can vary that position.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mitch W. says, would Mr. Leone talk a bit about two-seat Roadster, please?
I wished I could. Okay. That's a fun topic. Those are great to work on. I've had a chance in my career to work on a few of those, even have a couple in the garage.
What did you work on?
I was the chief engineer on the XLR concept all the way through production.
See, I was glad I made a mistake earlier when I was
Okay.
I was trying to say XTS, but I said XLR. That was a great car.
I have one of those at home.
Great looking car.
V series.
When you see them on today, it's just like cool. You don't see those every night.
I spent 5 years of my life, 6 years of my life on that one, and it was a fantastic period. It's capable, but we don't have any announcements here to make relative to that.
Okay, VRM Chris wants to know, will there be a version of the ATS platform for Holden? I don't think he can talk about that one either.
I'm not allowed to talk about it. It's very capable.
He says, we know that the next generation Camaro will be based on the ATS platform. How small would you go for rear wheel drive? About the size of a BMW 1 Series?
It's capable of doing that quite easily.
And will the V6 and the ATS get a 6-speed manual in the future?
No, not at this point. Okay. In the future, I mean, anything's possible. But our objective here and our strategy was to have something for everybody, not everything for everybody. And the General Motors of the past would have had all drive configurations and all transmissions for every powertrain. We focused our resources where we think the sweet spot in the market is. And so if you want a 6-speed manual, we have that with the two-liter turbo.
With the hot 4-cylinder.
Yes, absolutely. And
so that's the best balance?
It really is. In this segment, the number that you sell with manual transmissions is still pretty limited.
Yeah.
I have the 6-speed manual available on the CTS today. And last year we sold about 200 of them.
That's amazing.
For the non-V series. V series, we sell about 20% manuals. So stay tuned.
Chuck Grenchy wants to know, do you have any comment on Hennessy's CTS-V 1,226 horsepower tuner car and the acceptance to the Bugatti Veyron Challenge? And he says the challenge is that nothing can equal a Veyron.
Well, I would. It would be a fun test to run, I've got to say that. Hennessy does a great job with putting power to the ground in these vehicles and getting more and more out of them. It ought to be appreciably lighter than the Veyron. So with similar horsepower, I'd put my money on the lighter car.
Well, aero is going to play a big role at that point.
You know, and just on the CTS coupe, Okay, we did that when Bob Lutz was our vice chairman, and I was the chief for that one as well, and took it through the entire phase. And its aero is respectable, but it's nothing that you go ahead and advertise. Okay. And we talked to Bob, and he said, Bob, you know, this is where the arrow's at on it. He said, I don't care. He says, that's the car I want. Make it look just like that. We did the concept car.
He was right.
He was absolutely right. People don't buy that car for the arrow performance.
Right.
Okay? They buy it because what it looks like.
It's beautiful.
What you clearly recognize that as a Cadillac, and there's no question what it is, and it's gorgeous. And so we could have made it more aerodynamic, but it wouldn't be the same car. And so he absolutely gave us the right direction.
Wright Knight wants to know, will the next standard Cadillac V6 be a 3-liter DI turbo V6 to replace the naturally aspirated 3.6?
Could be.
Okay. Let's see. Oz in Fulton, New York says, what can you tell me about the 06-08 Cadillac XLR? They sure look great, he says. I'm currently eyeing an 06 Star Black with 17,000 miles.
Okay. Base car or V-series? It doesn't say.
Well, he says he's not sure he would go as far as a V model.
Okay. That is a very low mileage. That would be a sweetheart to pick up. You can get those for a pretty reasonable price, just looking at where they're at right now.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of, having that be a family member, I stay close to them, but those were really nice cars. They were quiet, reliable. Any of the initial challenges were worked out by then, and so that's a very good model to go after.
So what was the runner? Was it 2003?
04. 04 model.
Okay, so
the fall of 03 mm-hmm. through April of 09.
Mm-hmm. So collector's items, really. You didn't sell a whole lot of those things.
We didn't, and I should know the total number, but I don't want to give you a bad number.
Mm-hmm.
But we started out 4,000 to 5,000 a year, and towards the end ended up about half that. So,
Brian, I don't know if this is Brian I or Brian 1 or Brian L, but Brian, here's your question. He says, I've seen the new XTS at my local dealer and really like the general layout of the car. Until I walk around back and see how the chimpsel has been added to the trunk lid. He says it's just a large red piece of plastic that does not fit at all well with the balance of the car. Please make a second option available, like a small spoiler with an integrated light. He says, thanks, I've watched After Hours from day one.
Mm, okay.
I disagree with him, and I know you're going to disagree with him, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we have certain design elements that are part of what we call Cadillac design vocabulary, and vertical headlamps, vertical tail lamps, and a full-length center high-mounted stop lamp is also part of the Cadillac design vocabulary. So it may not be for everybody, but it is part of that vocabulary. It also is functional. Okay, if you notice, those are not horizontal. They're always tipped up a little bit. And
it is a wing.
It is a wing.
Or a spoiler, right?
What it does is, the car doesn't have net downforce, but what it does is it reduces the rear lift that you get in the vehicle. And so on these vehicles here, which are capable of north of 150 miles an hour, that becomes really important. And so we do tune it, and you can get appreciable downforce, a reduction in rear lift as a result of that.
See, I like it for a number of reasons. Number one, instead of just sticking a chimpsel, a center high-mounted stoplight, for those who don't know the term, and just sticking it in the back window or somewhere on the car, you guys have made it a functional element.
Right.
That, I mean, it's functional, and yet it's also a styling element in the car, too. So.
Well, yeah, plus Ed and his team, part of the design of the rear Cadillac are Wisp-O-Fin.
Mm-hmm.
Just a wisp of a fin from the old days. It's mm-hmm. kind of cool.
Yeah, but you got to give it up to him. You know, I'm thinking back when you guys did the STS and you had that long mm-hmm. chimsel back there, and you had to do the laser cutting to get mm-hmm. that. And, you know, it's like
had
nobody
that one too.
You know, and nobody else was doing that. And then Cadillac did, and
sure.
It was like. And it was like, it wasn't LED, but it looked...
They actually were. Those were LEDs. I think there were 48 of them.
Yeah, I mean, it was like way ahead of anybody doing that. And
correct.
It was just, but yeah,
correct.
I mean, it was.
You know, the interesting piece, and many folks don't know it, but the LEDs that are used in tail lamps and chimsels are actually faster than an incandescent bulb. And we've actually translated this into, if you will, improved response time. Mm-hmm. And so by having that those types of lights back there, you see it faster, and you with that notice, you can stop faster. And it can be worth, I'm going to say it's up to 3 or 4 feet
at 60 miles an hour. Okay, right.
And, you know, the difference between 3 or 4 feet can be, you know, in the guy's trunk or back seat versus avoiding the contact. And so it can be very important.
And it is amazing because I remember when those first LEDs came out and there were incandescent tail lamps, but LED chimsels. Right. You would see the chimsel come on just a nanosecond or a second before the taillights would.
And these cars have LEDs in both chimsels and the tail lamps for that consistency, the design appearance, and again, that's part of the Cadillac character.
Yeah. So even the lights are fast.
They are fast.
Ray Schaffer wants to know, he says, my question for David is, any lessons learned from the Pratt & Miller CTS racing program? Do you engineers spend time learning from the race experience?
We do. We do. I know Gary Pratt personally. We have a chance to work together with them. And I was going to, when we were talking about lightweight bodies, okay, one of the things, if you were able to take the fenders off of this vehicle, you would see trusses, okay, that go from the what we call a front body hinge pillar, which is basically where the doors mount, okay, to the shock tower. There's a triangular truss that's in there that looks very similar to what you see on custom-built race cars. And so we do try and transfer knowledge from the...
So that truss is right out of the racing program?
It's similar.
Or racing experience?
It's lessons from the racing program.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had the Corvette program for a while, and we work that as well with them. And we learn a great deal. You race on Sunday, and you you learn and bring it to work on Monday. And so that is something that still is true today.
AM Guerrero wants to know, is a performance model with a twin-turbo V6 being considered?
Possibly.
And can Cadillac, he also asks, can Cadillac be the standard again if you benchmark Europeans? Isn't that a danger of benchmarking, is all you do is sort of get to where everyone else is?
No. Benchmarking means learning. That's just a fancy term for learning, understanding the competition better than you ever did before. You can surpass them. Benchmarking is just the approach you use to understand what they've done and why.
I think that's changed a little bit over the years for GM.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the old days, benchmarking was, this is every bit as good as this, and then the new version of that would come out 3 weeks later. But, and it's like
when we create a car and we establish what it's going to be, we pick the areas where it needs to win. Now, you can't win in every area of the car, or it wouldn't be affordable. But we pick the areas that we need to win, and if you aren't going to win, then you don't play there, and that's the way we operate.
Well, yeah, and I also think what difference I've seen in GM and Ford and the true believers at Chrysler is they have decided, like you said, stay the course. You have to have a vision for what you want to do.
Yep.
You have to understand who you are and what you want to do. I mean, you can't just say, well, we want a little of that, we want a little of that. No, it's what do you guys want to do?
Right.
What do you guys believe in? Do you believe in building a lightweight car that handles well and belongs at the table? Then fine. That's what you did, you know.
Yeah.
But I think in the old days, and I'm going back a ways, it wasn't like that.
No. There were periods of time where the looks were what you had to market and separate you from the others, and it needs to be far deeper than that. It's got to be in the DNA of the car. You got to get down to the bones, and the bones have to be right for the rest of the car to be right and win. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we tried to do here.
And like you're saying, Peter, I mean, staying focused is so important. Don't get distracted by shiny new objects that come out, you know, and it's like, oh, look at they did. Now we have to react to that.
But, I mean, it's interesting, you know, you said that you pick spots that you're going to be number one in, and it was not all spots. It seems to me back in the day, that was the, like, oh, we're the best in everything. You know, it's like, well, you can't afford to do that.
No.
But we did it.
Yeah.
Well, you didn't.
No, we didn't, yeah.
You know, I mean, but everybody said they, you know, so,
you aren't being honest with yourself.
Right.
If you said you did.
But I mean, so that, you know, that's a great thing that you guys said. This is where we're at.
Yep.
Okay. Jay Cujo's is challenging you here. He says, can you please explain to me why on a Cadillac ATS you have to upgrade to almost the highest trim level in order to get rid of the plastic covers where the fog lights go? I mean, this is Cadillac we're talking about, he says. Add a thin chrome accent or something. On a base model Buick Verano, you get fog lamp standard, and that is almost $15,000 cheaper. What gives? Shouldn't they be standard equipment for a Cadillac? Your competition, BMW, Lexus, Mercedes, gives them to you standard. You have the same problem with the CTS as well, he says.
Okay. You don't have, we have four different models. Okay, we have the standard car, then we have the luxury model, then we have premium, and you have performance. And when you get to the premium, which is the third, not the fourth, is when you get those. Now, they're not fog lamps. They're part of the light signature. They're LEDs, okay, and they're part of our daytime running lamp execution, but they're really not fog lamps. But there's a need to have separation between the models, and we believe they're appropriately priced. You can get those with a four-cylinder. You can get those with a six-cylinder. This one here is a two-liter turbo, and it has them, and it is not the top of the line.
Good. Well, there you go. You got the answer now. Yeah.
What about the hat?
Well, I was just about to say we're at the top of the hour here, so we really do have to figure out a winner for this beautiful stitched Triumph baseball cap.
Motorcycle.
Triumph motorcycles with a little, I don't know if you can see it right here, a little pin with the Union Jack on it. It must be exquisite. Otherwise, Peter wouldn't be giving it away as a contest.
It's midnight blue, too, which is kind of cool.
So we've got...
This is color internet, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it is.
So I'm going to close my eyes. I've got the list of names where we've got correct answer. Oh, because the question was, what was the first international sports car race that a Cadillac-powered machine competed in? And who entered that car?
And what year?
And so since these are the correct answerers, Peter, why don't you give what the correct answer is?
Correct answer is 1950, the 24-hour Le Mans, and the entry was by Briggs Cunningham, very famous.
Who went on to Cunningham fame later.
Very, very famous semi-amateur, almost pro into sports car racing, and it's part of Cadillac's heritage, really. And the French, that's when the French began their love affair with American V8s.
So I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to point at the iPad here, and whosoever name my finger lands on is going to win this hat. So here we go. And the winner is... Oh, I missed. Here we go again.
Yeah.
And the winner is Lee Butler from Norman, Oklahoma. So congratulations, Lee, for getting that right.
Congratulations, Lee.
And shoot us an email with your address on it, and we'll put this in the mail out to you. But and with that, we're going to have to wrap up here. But David Leone, great having you on here, talking all about Cadillac.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have one of the true believers, and kudos to your group.
Thank you. Thank you. It's team sport, and it takes an army of passionate men and women to bring a car like this to market, and I'm just glad to be among them.
And how is that 2014 Corvette doing? Yeah. I'm sure you've seen it.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
No
he
idea.
Knows nothing.
It's a Sergeant Schultz.
Right. Yeah, what was that? What was that title yours that you have now?
The Executive Chief Engineer.
Rear wheel drive.
Yeah.
So you know quite a bit about C7.
Sworn to secrecy.
Gary Vasslash, great having you back on the show,
John.
Too.
Thanks, Gary.
Peter, always good having you. And remember, folks, next week, we're going to have Mike Cairns. I think I'm saying that right. Cairns, the chief engineer of the vehicle line executive on the Dodge Ram. So join us for that show as well. And thanks so much for having me here.
Thanks for tuning in, folks.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.